This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
I'm Dr. Kathy Lee, and I teach political science. Welcome. I have the honor tonight of introducing Professor Randall Balmer, who's chair of the Religion Department at Dartmouth College. Professor Balmer received his bachelor's degree in history from Trinity College, his PhD in religion from Princeton University, and his master's of divinity from Union Theological Seminary. He's also an ordained Episcopal priest, as is his wife, I learned tonight. Professor Balmer's interests in American religion are wide-ranging. In my course, In American Presidency, I use his book, God in the White House, How Faith Shaped the Presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush. And I really would like to be taking his course this fall, Sports, Ethics, and Religion, since there's so much it seems to be talking about with regards to ethics and organized sports right now in American society. His most recent book is Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter, which will be available for you to purchase, and I think he might sign some books afterwards outside. And on a personal note, what I've always appreciated about Professor Balmer's approach about religion in America, it comes from a very thoughtful place. It comes from his own commitment to the Christian tradition, and I've always appreciated that in his writings. And I think he also, we may have a new record set. He's also maybe the only person we've had appear on Whitworth's campus twice in 2 weeks. Last Thursday night, he was here on campus in the documentary that Marky Hancock showed. And now we are pleased to have you here in person. Welcome to Whitworth, Professor Balmer.
I'm delighted to be here. This is my first visit to Whitworth, and I have a couple of friends and colleagues from years ago who are graduates of Whitworth, and I've always held Whitworth in high esteem, and my visit so far to campus has not at all diminished that. I'm here to talk to you tonight about Jimmy Carter, and I see it as my challenge to let you know why you should care about Jimmy Carter. Now, for some people, that's a hard sell, I realize, but the basis of my remarks is a remarkable new book, stunning in its analysis, called Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. Let me tell you a little bit about how I came to write this book. Jimmy Carter came to prominence nationally when I was a student at Trinity College back in the early 1970s. And what caught my attention is that he described himself unabashedly as a born-again Christian, which of course is what I used to describe myself and the other people that Trinity used to describe themselves as well. And it caught my attention and it caught our attention because usually when we talked about ourselves in those terms, in religious terms, we did so with some diffidence, with some shyness and uncertainty. But Jimmy Carter was different in the sense that he was very proud of this, and he talked about this as being a very, very important part of his life. And I believe it has been and continues to be a very, very important part of his life, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit tonight. I'm going to start with some biographical details. Jimmy Carter was born on October 1st, 1924, which means that he will celebrate his 90th birthday next Thursday. I'm sorry, this Thursday, pardon me, this Thursday, October 1st, I think that's right, Thursday, October 1st, Jimmy Carter will be 90 years old. He's the first American president, a bit of trivia for you if you want it, first American president to be born in a hospital. You can win a Coke somewhere with that bit of trivia if you want. Feel free to use it. His mother, Lillian Carter, was a kind of itinerant nurse there in Plains, Georgia, which is in southwest Georgia, and so she had access to medical facilities that many other people in that time and place did not. So Jimmy Carter is the first American president born in a hospital. He grew up the first few years of his life in Plains, And then about age 3, his family moved just 3 miles down the road to the small town, it's not even a town really, called Archery, Georgia. I'm wondering if anybody's ever been to the Jimmy Carter home site in Archery, Georgia? I guess not. My overall impression the first time I visited there was how modest it was. Here was a place where a president grew up, and it wasn't, we're not talking Abraham Lincoln here, but we're talking a pretty modest farm. Electricity did not come to the farmhouse there in Archery until Jimmy Carter was 14 years old. Jimmy Carter's always been careful to say that he and his family were more prosperous than many of their neighbors, but nevertheless, if you visit that farm, and I invite you to do so because it's really an interesting place to go, you will not be overwhelmed with the sumptuousness of his childhood. It was not that at all. He went to school in Plains, very often walking barefoot to school. He was a country boy. And he set about to get himself a good education. One of the teachers who was most influential for him was a woman named Julia Coleman. And Julia Coleman spent her summers at the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York. Anyone ever heard of the Chautauqua Institution? Some of you have. It's quite a venerable place. A place where people gather every summer for cultural enrichment, but also for adult education. And one of the features of the Chautauqua Institution is a book club, which claims to be the oldest book club in the country. And one summer after Julia Coleman came back to Plains from Chautauqua Institution, she decided to set up a book club, very likely modeled on the Chautauqua Book Club. And she challenged young Jimmy Carter to read Leo Tolstoy's classic, War and Peace, which, unless you probably know, weighs in somewhere north of about 1,200 pages. Jimmy Carter thought War and Peace was a book about cowboys and Indians, and so he plunged in and soon learned otherwise, but nevertheless persisted to finish the reading of War and Peace. After he graduated from Plains High School, he went off to the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. This was a long time aspiration of his to be able to do that, and studied there in Annapolis, graduating 60th in his class at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. Several weeks after he graduated, he got married to a woman named Rosalind Smith back in Plains, and in Plains, Georgia, that counted as a mixed marriage because Jimmy Carter was a Southern Baptist and Rosalind Smith was a Methodist. Nevertheless, they worked it out and joined the Plains Baptist Church. Jimmy Carter was an ensign in the U.S. Navy and had a lot of attractive postings in various places, including Hawaii and actually out here in Washington. He was here for a while as well. And in 1953, he received word that his father, Earl Carter, was dying of pancreatic cancer back in Plains. He got a leave from his military duties and went to his father's bedside as he was dying. One of the real surprises to me as I was writing the biography was learning that the real moral and formative influence on Jimmy Carter's life was not Miss Lillian, his mother, who many of the older folks here in this room remember from the 1976 campaign, a rather remarkable woman, but was instead his father, Earl Carter, who died at the age of 53. And what Jimmy Carter witnessed while standing at his father's bedside as he was dying was people from the community coming in to pay their respects to the man they called Mr. Earl and to thank him for various discreet, quiet acts of kindness that he had shown to them over the course of their lives. The time, for example, when a family wanted to be able to attend their daughter's high school graduation and to do so with pride, but the clothes they had there in the family were old and ratty, and Mr. Earl gave them money so that they could buy new clothes and attend their daughter's graduation. The time that he paid the mortgage for another family that was facing financial stringencies for a time. many, many people came in talking about the time that Mr. Earle had extended them credit from his store, from the warehouse, so that they could plant their crops or feed their families. And Jimmy Carter was very, very impressed with this because this is the first he'd heard about any of these acts of kindness that his father had shown toward others in the community. Earle Carter was also a deacon in the Plains Baptist Church. He was a Sunday school teacher. He was also a leader of a youth group in the Southern Baptist Convention called the Royal Ambassadors. And all of that taken together was very influential on Jimmy Carter. And so after Earle Carter died, Jimmy Carter went back to Schenectady, New York, where he was posted with Rosalind, and informed Rosalind that he intended to resign his commission in the Navy and return to Plains to try to have the kind of life and the kind of influence that his father, Earle Carter, had had. Rosalind was not amused. She liked being a Navy wife. She liked traveling. She liked living in different places. And apparently the word divorce crept into their conversation several times during that period in their life. And the car trip from Schenectady, New York, all the way down to Plains, Georgia, transpired in almost total silence between these two very strong-willed individuals. Nevertheless, she got used to it, and the Carters settled back in Plains back in 1953. Carter set about becoming a businessman, running the Carter farm and store interests and the other businesses associated with the Carter Warehouse. The first year, he turned a profit of only $200, but he applied himself, learned the mechanics of farming as well as techniques in business, and very quickly, the Carter Warehouse was turning a profit. On October 1st, 1962, his 38th birthday, Jimmy Carter got out of bed and put on his Sunday trousers rather than his workaday trousers and announced to Rosalind that he was going down to Americus, which was the county seat, to file papers to run for the Georgia State Senate. This is the first that Rosalind had heard about this plan to run for political office. When I asked Carter about this, he said, "I really can't believe I did that," he said. But 1962 was a very different time and place, and he's since kind of repented of this. But at the time, when I talked about it with him, he was just kind of embarrassed that he had done that without consulting Rosalind first. Rosalind got into the act by making phone calls on his behalf, by designing campaign literature. Jimmy Carter took whatever few hours he could spare from the Carter business interests and went around to different places in the district to try to introduce himself to voters. He worked very hard and seemed to be doing pretty well in his campaign for the Georgia State Senate. Turns out, however, that a local political boss in Quitman County, Georgia, a cigar-chomping sheriff by the name of Joe Hurst, had a different candidate that he wanted to see elected to the Georgia State Senate, and he mounted a rather remarkable get-out-the-vote effort on behalf of Herman Moore rather than Jimmy Carter. A really remarkable get-out-the-vote effort. Turns out that out of something like 330 registered voters in Quitman County, 362 showed up to vote for Herman Moore over Jimmy Carter. And they did so, most of them, alphabetically, down to the second and third letters in their surnames. It was really quite a remarkable effort, the envy of any political party, even to this day, I'm sure. Well, Jimmy Carter writes about this in his book called Turning Point, his first campaign for political office, and the pages of that book just bristle with anger and moral indignation. He had trusted this political system, and the system betrayed him, and he was going to make it right, and he did. Rather remarkably, he was able to get the courts behind him and a couple of journalists who wrote about this, and so Jimmy Carter takes the oath of office as a Georgia State Senator in January of 1963. He again throws himself into his work and decides 4 years later, 1966, to run for governor of Georgia. Again, he campaigns very hard. He loses 22 pounds over the course of the campaign because he's working so hard. He invests a lot of money into that campaign, and he loses. And not only does he loses to a man that some people in this room will recognize, and the others, I'll explain it to you in a minute. He loses to, of all people, Lester G. Maddox. Lester Maddox was an owner of the Pickrick restaurant in Atlanta, Georgia. And the day after Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, on July 2nd, 1964, Lester Maddox took an axe handle in his restaurant, went out into the parking lot, and threatened three African Americans who were coming to eat in his restaurant. He wanted to maintain a segregated restaurant, even though that was now against the law after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That act got him all sorts of publicity. He began selling axe handles at his restaurant for $2 a piece to patrons, and he used that celebrity to catapult himself into the governor's mansion in Georgia in 1966. Jimmy Carter was devastated by this loss. Not only had he lost a lot of money in the sense that he put money into the campaign, he lost a lot of weight, but he wasn't sure what to do, and he couldn't believe that God had allowed, of all people, Lester Maddox to be elected governor over Jimmy Carter. Friends and family talk about him, seeing him in Plains, walking around town, walking through the fields, very often in tears, trying to figure out what went wrong, trying to figure out how to reclaim his life and his political career. And it's at this point that he has a very important religious experience. One of Jimmy Carter's siblings was his sister, Ruth Carter Stapleton, a Pentecostal evangelist. And so at this time in Jimmy Carter's life, when he was utterly disconsolate, at the low point for his sense of well-being and his self-esteem, she comes to Plains and they have a long, long conversation, the result of which is that Jimmy Carter rededicates his life to Jesus and to his faith. Jimmy Carter, like many Southern Baptists, had his own born-again experience. For Carter, it was at the age of 11 in 1935, after which he was baptized into the Plains Baptist Church. But this rededication of his life in 1967 really was a formative moment. So much so that shortly thereafter, Jimmy Carter goes on a mission trip with other Southern Baptist laymen to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, where they go around knocking on doors, telling people about Jesus. The first time I met Carter was in 2007, I believe it is, at an event at Emory University in a rather small group. And what he wanted to talk about in that conversation was what he called the unsurpassed joy of telling others about Jesus. This was an important moment for him. Later that same year, he goes on another mission trip, this one to Springfield, Massachusetts, where he's paired with a Puerto Rican minister by the name of Eloy Cruz from New York City. And they go around into Spanish-speaking neighborhoods. And Carter, who has at least a rudimentary command of Spanish, would read from the Bible, and then Pastor Cruz would preach and would talk to these families about accepting Jesus into their hearts. At the end of that week, Carter asked Cruz, he said, "Why is it you're successful? Why is it that your faith is so compelling? How can I be like you?" In effect, is what he was asking. And Cruz was diffident. He didn't want to answer the question because he considered Carter to be superior to him. And Carter kept pressing him. And finally, he said, "Senior Jimmy, the secret to a life of faith is to have two loves in your life, one for God and the other for whatever person happens to be standing in front of you at any given time." And Jimmy Carter has talked about this time and time and again as being formative for his understanding of the faith. 1970, Jimmy Carter runs a second time for governor of Georgia. And this campaign is not pretty because Jimmy Carter courts the segregationist vote in that 1970 campaign in order to be elected governor. He gets the endorsement from the head of the White Citizens Council in Georgia, which is known colloquially as the Uptown Klan. And in fact, in the final days of the campaign, he actually endorses Lester Maddox for lieutenant governor. At that time, governors of Georgia could not succeed themselves. So while Carter was running for governor, Lester Maddox was running for lieutenant governor, and Jimmy Carter endorsed him. This is a great example of fallenness and sin. And I don't make any attempt to whitewash Jimmy Carter. He was not a saint, certainly not in this 1970 campaign. But I think he sought almost immediately to redeem himself. And here I mention this wonderful new book called Redeemer. This is the first sense in which I mean redeemer. Because Jimmy Carter, when he took the oath of office as governor of Georgia on January 12, 1971, he famously announced that the time for racial discrimination is over. And he sought to act on that sentiment. He sought to reform Georgia's prisons, which overwhelmingly were populated with people of color, people who were poor, could not afford adequate legal representation. He introduced three portraits of African Americans into the Georgia State House, including Martin Luther King Jr. And at the unveiling of that portrait, there was a protest by Ku Klux Klansmen there at the state capitol. And he sought to act on issues that would help people who were on the margins of society. He wanted to reinforce and to strengthen public education, for example, because he recognized that public education was important, especially for those who didn't have access otherwise to schools and to education. His statement in his inaugural address that the time for racial discrimination is over was picked up the next morning on the New York Times, on the front page, above the fold. And several weeks later, Jimmy Carter's face appeared on the cover of Time magazine as an example of the so-called New South, that is, post-racial governor, along with Reuben Askew of Florida and Dale Bumpers of Arkansas. Let me take a break from Jimmy Carter to talk about what's happening in evangelicalism at this same time, because I think it's important for understanding the rise of Jimmy Carter as a political figure in the 1970s. Within evangelicalism in the early 1970s, there was a brief resurgence of what I call progressive evangelicalism. And to understand progressive evangelicalism, I need to go back the previous century and talk about evangelical activism and social reform movements in the 19th century, particularly in the antebellum period. In the 19th century, evangelicals were very active in social reform, trying to make the world a better place, trying to make America a better place. They were active, for example, in the abolitionist movement to abolish slavery. They were active in public education, what were known at the time as common schools, because evangelicals believed that especially the children of those less affluent should be able to get an education and thereby become upwardly mobile and someday to join the middle class. They were active in peace crusades in the antebellum period and even in gun control, believe it or not, even at that time. They were active in the temperance movement, which was aimed at very real social problems. Alcohol consumption in the early republic was just out of control, much more than by today's standards. And along with that came the problems of spousal abuse and child abuse. And evangelicals were active in trying to redeem that element in American society. They were active in prison reform. The whole idea of a penitentiary comes about at this time in American history. The idea that you would take a criminal and not merely segregate him from the rest of society, but try to rehabilitate him, make him penitent, so that he could at some point, constructively rejoin society. And finally, evangelicals were active in seeking equal rights for women, including voting rights, which in the 19th century was considered a radical cause. This movement of progressive evangelicalism continues throughout the 19th century and even into the 20th century with such people as William Jennings Bryan, who was the three-time Democratic candidate for president, very much interested in the rights of workers to organize, the rights of women to be seen as not only as voters, but as equal in American society and so forth. And then this progressive evangelicalism kind of fades, and then the reasons for that are rather complicated, and I won't get into all of them right now. But in the early 1970s, on the heels of the Vietnam War, there is this brief resurgence of progressive evangelicalism. The best evidence for this is a meeting that took place in Chicago, Illinois, at the YMCA on Wabash Street. 55 evangelical leaders, including people like Jim Wallace of Sojourners magazine, Richard Mao, who just retired as president of Fuller Theological Seminary, Carl F.H. Henry, a famous evangelical theologian, several African-American theologians, Paul Henry, who taught political science at Calvin College, and others. They got together in Chicago and hammered out a document called the Chicago Declaration of Evangelical Social Concern. And I invite you to look at this up on the internet. It's widely available. You can read it for yourself. But what's remarkable about this document is that it rehearses many of the same principles and issues that were characteristic of progressive evangelicalism in the 19th century. Decrying the persistence of racism in American society. Decrying the overwhelming dependence on militarism in American foreign policy. Decrying the growing gap between rich and poor. The persistence of hunger in an age of such, in a society of such affluence and plenty. And in particular, calling for equal rights for women. This takes place, as I said, in 1973. If I didn't say that, I'm saying it now. November of 1973 is when this gathering took place. And what I argue in part in the book is that Jimmy Carter's campaign for president, in part, rides this current of progressive evangelicalism. I'm not going to pretend for a moment that progressive evangelicals were solely responsible for his election as president. That simply was not the case, and I'm not pretending that's the case. But he rehearses many of those same sentiments when he starts to run for president in 1974. One of the key moments in Carter's governorship was an event in Athens, Georgia, at the University of Georgia Law School, which took place in May of 1974. It's called Law Day. This is when the graduating class at the law school invites dignitaries in to talk to them, usually senators or Supreme Court justices or attorneys general or somebody like people like that. And in fact, on this day, this Law Day in 1974, the keynote speaker was Edward Kennedy, the senator from Massachusetts. But Jimmy Carter was the undercard speaker. And after Kennedy finished, then Jimmy Carter got up and began extemporaneously to address these law students as well as the assembled dignitaries. And he began talking about his understanding of justice, where he derived his understanding of justice. And he cited two prominent theologians. One of them, perhaps unsurprisingly, was Reinhold Niebuhr, who often said that the sad duty of politics is to establish justice in a sinful world. And Carter has quoted that many, many times throughout his political career. But the second theologian he cited was the venerable theologian Bob Dylan. In particular, Bob Dylan's song, Ain't Gonna Work on Maggie's Farm No More, which talks about tenant farmers and the plight of tenant farmers. And Carter claimed in his address at the law school event that Dylan's song helped him understand the plight of those who were poor and disprivileged in American society. He goes on to talk about some of the things he had tried to do as president with the prison reform and other things. And he also decried the close connection between regulators in Washington in particular and the corporations they regulate. If that doesn't sound familiar, it should by now, especially given America's recent past with the bank crisis and the financial crisis and so forth. While he was talking, Carter noticed that one of the journalists who was in attendance disappeared out the back. And he thought that Hunter Thompson, who wrote for a Rolling Stone magazine known as the Gonzo Journalist, that's how he described himself, was simply going out to the parking lot to refresh whatever adult beverage he was drinking that day. But Thompson was going out to the parking lot to retrieve his tape recorder because he said he wanted to record something extraordinary, a politician willing to tell the truth, a politician willing to call powerful interests to account. And Hunter Thompson becomes one of Carter's biggest fans in his campaign for the presidency in 1976. Carter announces his campaign for the presidency on December 12, 1974, and then he took off to Iowa in particular, the precincts of Iowa, and to New Hampshire to campaign for the Democratic nomination. He was considered a long shot. In fact, the month before he announced his candidacy for the Democratic nomination, the Gallup poll had done a survey of Americans to gauge their interest in 32 possible candidates for president in 1976. Jimmy Carter was not one of the names they asked. So he came from utter nowhere to win the Democratic nomination in 1976. I also think that one of Carter's unheralded achievements was that he effectively ended the political career of a man who is probably America's most famous segregationist. On March 6, 1976, in the Florida primary, Jimmy Carter defeated the governor of Alabama, George C. Wallace, in the Democratic primary, thereby effectively ending George Wallace's national political ambitions. And I don't think Jimmy Carter gets enough credit for having slain that dragon, if I can use that language. Carter then wins the Democratic nomination. He's headed for a landslide victory. And then on September 20th, the newsstands come out with an interview in Playboy magazine that dropped him 15% in the polls. It was not a popular thing to do. He was trying to dispel the notion that he was kind of the sanctimonious, holier-than-thou Baptist, you know, being a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher and so forth. But it backfired. This is the interview where he famously said that he had lusted for women other than his wife in his heart. He'd had lust in his heart. And for evangelicals, this is an utterly unremarkable comment, utterly unremarkable sentiment. What did Jesus say in the Sermon on the Mount? Jesus said, the law says if you kill your brother, you should not kill your brother, but I tell you, if you hate your brother, it's as good as though you'd killed him. The law says don't commit adultery, but if you commit adultery in your heart, it's the same as committing adultery. It's an utterly unremarkable statement. But the press picked up on this, and you know, this adultery in your heart sort of thing, and political cartoons of Jimmy Carter looking at the Statue of Liberty and imagining her undressed and things like that. It's just utter silliness. But it hurt him politically, and what should have been a landslide victory in 1976 turned out to be rather close. And Jimmy Carter barely eked into the presidency. I use Redeemer in the title in the second sense because I think Jimmy Carter's election in 1976 essentially redeemed the nation from the sins of Watergate and Vietnam. Jimmy Carter burst onto the national scene, a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher who promised never to knowingly lie to the American people. I try to impress my students these days on how extraordinary that was. A president who wouldn't lie to us? We had just come out of Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson had lied to us about Vietnam. Richard Nixon had lied to us about pretty much everything. And Jimmy Carter comes along and says, I'm not going to lie to you. And I think in many ways, putting Jimmy Carter in office for many Americans redeemed this nation from the sins and from the stain and from the shame of both the Watergate and the Vietnam eras. Jimmy Carter comes into office. He realizes that America needs to renegotiate the Panama Canal treaties because if we are going to have any meaningful relationship with the countries, Latin America in particular, and with third world nations in general, we need to move away from the colonialism that had characterized American foreign policy. He also seeks to move American foreign policy away from the reflexive dualism of the Cold War toward an emphasis on human rights. And human rights to this day is part of the language and the rhetoric of American foreign policy, and it's because of Jimmy Carter. He sought to wean Americans from their dependence on foreign oil. Energy analysts claim that if we as a nation had listened to even half of his proposals and tried to enact them, we would be in a far different place today in terms of our energy dependence. Still, it was not a successful presidency, at least by many accounts. Inflation remained very, very high. He inherited the high inflation rate, and that remained high. Even though he added 8 million new jobs over the course of his presidency, it really didn't move the needle in terms of economic health for the nation. And, of course, the big issue for Carter as he faced re-election was the taking of the Iranian hostages on November 4th, 1979. And Carter spent the remainder of his presidency seeking to negotiate the release of these hostages in Iran. Now, I want to come back quickly, and I'm conscious of the time. I don't want to keep you real long here. Come back to what really was the issue around which I framed this biography. That is to say, why is it that America's evangelicals, who helped propel Jimmy Carter to the presidency in 1976, turned so dramatically against him 4 years later? I'm talking now, of course, about the rise of the religious right as a political movement in the 1970s, and why they turned their back on Jimmy Carter, one of their own, an evangelical Christian. Well, the standard narrative, and I'm sure you've heard this, is that evangelicals became very worried, very concerned morally about the implications of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade ruling of January 22, 1973, that effectively struck down laws limiting abortion. Many of the leaders of the religious right, including Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and others, have even gone so far as to characterize themselves as the so-called new abolitionists, trying to draw a parallel between their opposition to abortion and the efforts on the part of antebellum evangelicals to end the scourge of slavery. It's a great story, but it is also fiction. I began delving into this, well, at least 10 years ago, probably more than that, trying to figure out what it was that really got evangelicals interested in the political process and organizing politically. And one of my clues to the fact that abortion was not the answer to that question was a gathering that I attended in Washington in November of 1990, way back, a long time ago, more than 20 years ago now. And in that meeting were people like Ralph Reed, Carl Henry was there, Ed Dobson, who was one of Jerry Falwell's lieutenants at Moral Majority, Donald Wildman in the American Family Association, and Paul Weyrich, who is really the architect of the religious right, a conservative activist. And in the first session in that gathering, Paul Weyrich made the point, in response to somebody else's comment, that abortion had nothing to do with the mobilization of the religious right or conservative evangelical voters. And he was emphatic about this. And with the session, then we had a break, and so I went over and I talked to him. I said, I want to make sure I understood you correctly. Abortion had nothing. He said, absolutely nothing, he said. I'd been trying since the Goldwater campaign in 1964 to get evangelicals organized politically. He said, I tried everything I could think of. I tried the school prayer issue, which in the 1960s was a huge issue because the Supreme Court struck down organized public prayer in public schools. I tried the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution as a way to get them mobilized. I tried the abortion issue as a way to get them mobilized. I tried the pornography issue to get them mobilized. Nothing worked until the school issue came along. Well, I began poking around a little bit further in this, and I've decided, and again, this is all meticulously documented in this remarkable book. I found that the real catalyst for conservative evangelical political action was a court decision, but it wasn't Roe v. Wade. It was another court decision, District Court, District of Columbia, handed down on June 30th, 1971, in a case called Green v. Connolly. Now, let me explain the background of this. I mentioned earlier that on July 2nd, 1964, Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act forbids any public institution from engaging in racial segregation or racial discrimination. In other words, and this was long an issue for African Americans. If you own a motel out in, I don't know what the highways are around here, but you get somewhere. It used to be the case that you could choose, I mean, especially in the South, but across the country, there were black hotels, there were white hotels. So if you were a white motel owner or a restaurant owner, you could refuse to let a room to an African-American family, or you could refuse to serve African-Americans in your restaurant. Well, Title VI did away with that, legally. What was happening at that time in the 1960s, at the same time, is that because of the Brown v. Board of Education ruling of 1954, public schools were being desegregated. And in response to this, especially in the South, but not entirely the South, many churches were opening their own schools, which came to be known as segregation academies. That is, if you remember the church, or even if you weren't a member of the church, you could send your child to this school, the church school, the segregation academy, so the child would not have to go to school alongside of African Americans. These were cropping up all over the place. And in Holmes County, Mississippi, what's happening is that in the first year of desegregation of the public schools, the number of white children in the public schools drops from 728 to 21. The second year of desegregation, that number drops to zero. At the same time, these segregation academies are cropping up, and they are applying to the Internal Revenue Service for tax-exempt status. Some families down in Holmes County, Mississippi said, this is wrong. And they filed suit against the granting of tax-exempt status to these segregation academies. The Green v. Connolly ruling in 1971 upheld the Internal Revenue Service, which said, in effect, any organization that engages in racial discrimination is not, by definition, a charitable organization, and therefore, it has no claims on tax-exempt status. And the District Court, District of Columbia, upheld that opinion. What happens then is that over the ensuing years, the Internal Revenue Service sends out questionnaires to these segregation academies to ask about their enrollments and ask about their racial policies. Another place they send a questionnaire is Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, which until 1971 did not admit African Americans to the student body. And when they did, they admitted a part-time student who was a worker in the school's radio station, who remained a student at the school for just a month before dropping out. The IRS, after years of warnings, finally rescinded the tax exemption of Bob Jones University on January 19th, 1976. That is what got the attention of people like Jerry Falwell, Paul Weyrich, and the other organizers and leaders of the religious right. Jerry Falwell, of course, had his own segregation academy back in Lynchburg, Virginia. He famously complained that in some states, it's easier to open a massage parlor than it is to open a Christian school, by which he meant a segregation academy. This is what got evangelicals organized politically, the leaders at least. How did abortion become part of the question? Again, it's a longer story than I really have time to get into, but what happens is that in the midterm elections in 1978, there are three Senate seats in the Midwest that are up for grabs. And going into the election, two of them in Minnesota, one for the unexpired term of Hubert Humphrey, and one in Iowa. And going into that election, the Democratic nominees are considered to be shoo-ins. They were going to win. The final weekend of that campaign, however, pro-life activists, Roman Catholics, because at that time abortion was a Catholic issue, leafleted church parking lots on the final Sunday of the campaign. And 2 days later, in a campaign with a very low turnout, Republican pro-life candidates defeated the Democratic candidates. As I was reading through the archives for Paul Weyrich, which are located, improbably enough, in Laramie, Wyoming, at the University of Wyoming, and I came across the correspondence surrounding that campaign, the papers sizzle with excitement. Weyrich had finally found the issue that would galvanize and organize evangelical voters, that is, opposition to abortion. Now, this is 1978, the fall of 1978, not 1973 when the Roe v. Wade ruling was handed down. In fact, I'll go back to there for a minute. In 1971, the Southern Baptist Convention, which is not exactly a stronghold of liberalism, passed a resolution calling for the legalization of abortion, a resolution they reaffirmed again in 1974 and 1976. When the Roe v. Wade ruling was handed down, W.A. Criswell, one of the most famous fundamentalists of the 20th century, a First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, applauded the Roe v. Wade ruling as marking an appropriate distinction between personal morality and public policy. It was not abortion that got evangelical activists interested in the political process in the 1970s. It was effectively the defense of segregation at Bob Jones University and other places. Well, my time is running out here. Let me just try to quickly come to a conclusion. The third sense of redemption is Jimmy Carter's own redemption after suffering a devastating political loss in 1980 when he was running for re-election. This is the election where Ronald Reagan wins by a landslide over Jimmy Carter. Ronald Reagan, in part, running as an anti-abortion candidate, but also very critical throughout that campaign of the IRS actions against Bob Jones University and other places. Jimmy Carter and Rosalynn Carter returned to Plains after the White House. Carter was discouraged. Rosalynn was furious. She was angry at everybody and really and not in good shape. And Carter told me that one of the reasons that he himself rebounded so quickly after that loss is that he had to keep reminding Rosalynn that they still had a life together, they still could do good in the world, even though he was no longer president of the United States. And that is what he has done. He really has redeemed himself, I think, in many ways. My favorite quote about Jimmy Carter comes from James Laney, the former president of Emory University. He said about Jimmy Carter, he's the only president in history, only person in history, for whom the presidency was a stepping stone. And I think it really does capture what he has done. The Carter Center is a remarkable institution. The Carter Center fights tropical diseases and has succeeded in eradicating several tropical diseases in places like Africa and Latin America. Jimmy Carter is still mediating disputes so that military action is not necessary. Very famously, the United States was sending warships to Haiti, and Carter was engaging in negotiations up to the last minute and finally averted a military confrontation with his mediatorial efforts. He's monitored elections throughout the world, ensuring that democracy would be observed. He's, of course, built houses for Habitat for Humanity. This is not a Carter Center initiative. It's a separate organization. But he's lent his name and his efforts to that Habitat for Humanity project as well. So in that sense, I think Jimmy Carter has redeemed himself. And I'm conscious of the time here, so let me conclude by reading a section from the epilogue, which is an account of my visit to Jimmy Carter in Plains, Georgia, a year ago in June, when I went to visit him for his Sunday school class, and then have a conversation with him. We had our conversation after the Sunday school, after church, and then he wanted to give me a book, so he asked me to follow him into the Carter compound, so I did, and he went into the house, and Rosalynn and I were talking at the car in the driveway, and she was talking about the roses that he had planted for her on Mother's Day many years ago. He comes out and he says, "I couldn't find you a new copy," Carter said as he handed me the book. So he had cadged Rosalynn's copy from the nightstand. "I figured I could get you another book," he said with a tentative smile as he glanced in her direction. "You're on page 70. Rosalynn Carter's bookmark was still in my copy of Through the Year with Jimmy Carter. On page 70, the meditation entitled Patience in Love. Now, if I'd made that up, nobody would believe me, but that's actually true. These are my final reflections here. As the caravan rumbled past the security gates toward Carter's next appointment, I headed out of town on Highway 61, also known as Old Plains Highway, by way of Archery, which parallels the seaboard coastline railroad tracks that young Jimmy Carter walked as a boy in order to sell boiled peanuts in town for pocket money. All of Carter's life, it occurred to me, had been characterized by striving, an insatiable ambition to rise above his circumstances as a country boy, as a state politician, a Navy shipman, midshipman, as president, and beyond, as a respected world leader and humanitarian. In the course of his Sunday school lesson, Carter had referred to Martin Luther's notion of the priesthood of believers, that each of us is responsible directly to God, and that the priestly caste or the arrogation of ministerial authority actually impeded that relationship. But Carter failed to note Luther's other central criticism of medieval Catholicism, works righteousness, the popular understanding that individuals could earn salvation by dint of good works. Protestants are equally susceptible, seeking to prove by their good works that they are among the elect. As I passed the hardscrabble farm in Archery, it was difficult to escape the impression that Carter was driven, almost obsessed, by a kind of works righteousness. Carter always believed in the value of work. On the farm, hard work would sustain the family and bring profitability. At school, diligent study would lead to better opportunities. In Hyman Rickover's Navy, hard work might win praise or even a promotion. On the campaign trail, working harder than your opponent, an hour earlier every morning, or shaking more hands would lead to victory. Once in office, long hours, the resolve to read every piece of legislation, and attention to the minutiae of negotiations would ensure success and re-election. Carter's term in the White House disrupted that calculus. He faced intractable obstacles as president, the nation's chronic energy dependence, soaring interest rates, an Islamic revolution in Iran, political opposition within his own party that simply would not yield to hard work or longer hours. Carter's shattering electoral loss in 1980 represented not only the end of his political career, but also a repudiation of the notion that if he just worked harder and longer, his efforts would be rewarded. How could the electorate not recognize that he was doing everything humanly possible, working as diligently as he could to solve these problems? After absorbing his defeat and returning to Plains, Carter reaffirmed his commitment to works righteousness as a way to redeem his loss. The Carter Center would be an activist institution, not merely a celebratory one. Habitat for Humanity was nothing if not an activist organization. This former president would not retire quietly into private life. There was work to be done: eradicating disease, monitoring elections, building houses, reprimanding dictators and politicians, teaching Sunday school, heading off military confrontations, ending hunger, making peace. If Carter could work hard enough, if in religious terms he could accumulate enough merit, he might be able to tilt the balance of history in his favor. To a remarkable degree, Jimmy Carter's commitment to the ethic of works righteousness met with success. Although partisans continued to criticize and even to ridicule his presidency, historians now regard it more favorably, albeit with something less than unvarnished approbation. Carter's activities since leaving office earned him praise and even grudging admiration. The awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002 provided perhaps the ultimate validation of Carter's works righteousness. At what point, however, does Carter earn a reprieve from his moral exertions? When can he relax and settle into a hard-won retirement? Certainly not on a Sunday in Plains. Even after teaching Sunday school, attending church, posing with tourists, fielding questions from a biographer, and massaging Habitat for Humanity donors, as I was moseying down Highway 61 toward Archery, Carter was speeding off to the next event on a crowded calendar. The former president, pushing 90 years old, was still a restless man, consumed by a kind of frenetic benevolence. The striving continues. As Martin Luther recognized centuries earlier, those who subscribe to the ethic of works righteousness can never be certain they have accumulated enough merit. Jimmy Carter doesn't lack so much for passion as he does for respite. The man whose improbable election in 1976 redeemed the nation from the sins of Watergate has finally earned his own redemption. Jimmy Carter himself, however, may be the last to know. Thank you for your attention.